Georgia's DBHDD reminds people that the Good Samaritan Law can save lives during alcohol and drug overdoses. People are urged to call 911 and stay until help arrives. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Welcome to the start of a brand new week on Political Rewind. It's Monday, May 3rd. I'm Bill Nygut. I'm very glad to have you with us. I hope you all had a really wonderful weekend. For me, the highlight of the weekend was to see a horse that sold as a yearling for $1,000 and then sold subsequently for $25,000, I think, or $35,000 win the Kentucky Derby against a field of horses that sold for millions of dollars. That was just kind of a thrilling event on Saturday afternoon. I want to thank Donna Lowry for filling in for me on Friday. I had to take another day off, and she did a wonderful job, as we knew she would. But I'm here to stay for a while, and I want to get right to our panel today because we have so much to talk about. It's Monday, which means my partner on the show is Jim Galloway, former political columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jim, right before the show, you said to me that you had a big news story to break about the Raphael Warnock Senate race in 2022, which just proves to me, and by the way, we're teasing it now because we're going to talk coronavirus first, but it just proves that you may not be at the AJC anymore, but you are still in the game, Galloway.
Yeah, they tend to drag you back in, whether you like it or not, don't they?
I'm glad you're here today and that we have successfully dragged you back in. We're also joined by Dr. Karen Landman, a triple threat at the very least, a physician, an epidemiologist, and a health and medical journalist. Karen, thank you for joining us today. It's been a while since we've looked at coronavirus, but I think this is a really good time to assess where we stand in the first part of the show today. So thanks for being here.
I agree, and I'm so glad to be here with you all.
All right, let's talk about that to start. You know, Jim, I want to start by saying that we can never separate the politics of coronavirus, I think, from the public health aspects of the coronavirus. They've been a continuing thread through the entire pandemic. And the latest in terms of that is that on Friday, Governor Kemp lifted almost all of the remaining restrictions that the state had put in place, starting as long ago as last spring. That includes that there's no longer a need for restaurants to have kind of social distancing seating arrangements. Gyms don't need to have social distancing. Venues, entertainment venues, movie theaters and the like no longer have restrictions in place. By the way, in terms of restaurants, the governor said that people who work in the restaurants, servers and the like, no longer have to wear masks. And so, as with every decision in the virus, you have to look at the political as well as the public health implications. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, look, health policy is public policy, and all public policy is political policy. I think we have to accept that. And also, I mean, just this is a matter of political philosophy imposing itself on epidemiology. You've got you've got a governor, a Republican governor who's dedicated to keeping particularly small businesses up and operating. So that's his that has been one of his top concerns. And then you also have this is happening when we still got the Georgia still has one of the lowest vaccination rates in the country, and that speaks to a political philosophy in which you don't have a really active aggressive government. Governor Kemp is putting the onus on citizens to go out and get their vaccine rather than the vaccine coming to them. One of the things that I hope Karen will be talking about is the fact that we haven't, you know, it's late spring, the fall semester is looming at Georgia universities, And we have had very few universities other than Emory say whether they're going to require vaccinations before compacting all these students in dormitories in the fall.
Oh, yeah. Karen, I want you to bring you in. Galloway already laid out a few of the key issues here, among them the fact that we still lag behind much of the country in terms of shots in arms for coronavirus. And yet, the virus is slowing down. The latest numbers show that in like 42 states across the country, the virus is the rates of new infections are dropping dramatically. It's Karen, it feels like a conflicting and confusing message when you add what Governor Kemp has lifted with all of the other news about the virus. Talk to us about this.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, zooming out a little bit time-wise, I think it's not unreasonable to think there's going to be some seasonal element to this virus's dynamics, right? So any respiratory virus, a virus that is spread by people's breathing, is going to be more easily transmitted when everybody is trapped inside and crowded together. And when the weather warms up, it often helps with dispersing the virus among the people who are gathering, giving people opportunities to be outside together. It's not obviously the only contributor to the spread of the virus. And I think it would be a mistake for us to imagine that once it's dispersed enough and once we're vaccinated, partially vaccinated, we're kind of done. What we fear is that when things cool down a little more, or when people, go inside a lot because it's so hot that they must be indoors with air conditioning, that we're going to see increased spread of the virus. And it doesn't remain the same type of virus once it starts to spread again. That's one of the big issues here, is that we see a lot of mutation with this virus, as with any virus, and that leads to the emergence of these mutant variants, which have more transmissibility and in some cases are more dangerous to the people who contract those viruses. So we have an increasing threat from this virus as time moves on through the summer into a cooler season. And that increases the urgency for us to get shots into more arms before those shots become ineffectual. That is currently theoretical. We haven't seen that happen, but I think that's a real worry on the part of the people following these issues. So I think that getting the vaccine into arms is really a great priority for that reason.
Well, although I don't have the breakdown for the state of Georgia, the New York Times reported over the weekend that some 8% of people who received nationwide the first dose of vaccine have not opted, so far at least, to get a second dose. And that in and of itself, Karen, has got to be troubling. We do know the first dose provides a fair amount of protection, but the second dose is what puts you over the top, right?
Yeah, and I don't know the exact reasons why those people haven't come back for doses. I think some people forget. A lot of states also, some states don't have, or municipalities don't have, what's called second dose clinics specifically. So you don't, you're not actually always sure whether the people coming for what is, quote, a first dose are really just from out of town and getting their second dose there. People just get busy and confused, and they feel partially protected enough that they don't feel they need to get their second dose. I honestly, personally, am a little more concerned about how we're going to get the people who have no interest in even getting to that first dose in. And I think there are some creative things happening at state levels to try to make that happen. West Virginia recently offered its younger residents a $100 savings bond in exchange for getting their vaccines. And they're actually offering that retroactively to everybody in that group who got their vaccine already. But that's, you can incentivize it. And you can also, maybe you can convince some people who are really maybe politically swayed from getting the vaccine toward getting the vaccine by answering questions in those communities and having, trusted figures by those communities talk about their own experiences with COVID. But I think what ultimately will probably be the biggest mover toward getting vaccines in the arms of folks who are who still have questions is when the vaccine goes from being just emergency use authorized to being fully approved, because I think that's the point when schools and work sites will require it. And I think that will probably be the biggest mover in getting shots into arms.
Jim, we know that by the polling that it is Republicans who are more tend to be more, and especially Republican men who tend to be more resistant to getting vaccinated than other parts of the population. Even Governor Kemp, in making his announcement on Friday, you already mentioned, he said he's urging people to get vaccinated is his solution for why he opens everything up and people can be safe. And I did think that there was an interesting message in what he said when he said the surest way to open the economy back up is if everyone does get vaccinated. There is a message Republicans can send that at least offers a chance that maybe they can overcome the resistance that people who support Republicans have had to vaccinations.
Right, and that was an echo of what you saw a number of Republican members of Congress who were also MDs last week, who were framing the virus as a ticket to freedom. If you want to lose your mask in all situations, the best path toward it is with the vaccination. But I think to Karen's point is. It's now become spreading the vaccine has become a matter of grunt work. It is grassroots. It is shoe leather time, and this is coming at a time we're shutting down eight mass vaccine stations very shortly. You know, that's the volunteerism vaccination effort. That's going away, or it's being severely limited. Now you've got to hunt the people who don't have time, who are afraid of it, who are reluctant. But you've got to go to them rather than them coming to you.
I think that's important. You know, Karen, a few weeks ago on this show, Valerie Montgomery Rice, the president of Morehouse School of Medicine, who we were thrilled we were able to talk to on the show. You know, she had a plan that she talked about for Morehouse to take out mobile vaccination units and go through communities where there was some resistance to vaccines. And they were going to use the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, make it one and done. And then they were slowed down, of course, by the delay in, you know, the pause in allowing that vaccination to move forward. It's back on again now. And Jim makes an important point. If we don't go to the people, it's questionable whether they're going to come in, right?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of value in showing up in people's communities and, you know, the trusted people in those communities being the ones who show up and being the voice for the vaccine. And I think public health can do a lot. They can educate, they can provide talking points, they can supply vaccine, they can supply resources to go out to those communities. But I think the faces and voices that people need to hear are perhaps not the ones of public health officials, not the ones of government, but the ones of people they know and trust who have had COVID or have experience.
Karen Landman, we got a lot more to talk about with the vaccine, but right now the voices people need to hear are the folks here at GPB Radio who are encouraging everyone to become supporters of GPB. Yes, we are in the last days of our semi-annual, our pledge drive, our spring pledge drive. We still need your support. We still thank those of you who have already given it to us. If you haven't, here's how you can.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Jim Galloway and Karen Landman join us today for Political Rewind. Karen, let me start with you, if I may. In addition to what Governor Kemp did on Friday, the Atlanta City Council today is taking up an executive order that Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms executed late last week. She is now saying that there can be gatherings of up to 10,000 people, presumably in concert settings, and that she believes that's safe. We'll see how the city council responds to that today. But I want to get your thoughts on that, in part because you pointed Jim Galloway and I to a couple of articles from the New York Times, one of which is about a concert in Barcelona where it was kind of an experiment, a test to see whether the virus would spread there, and it didn't. So again, these kind of mixed and confusing signals about whether it's safe for us to lift these restrictions.
Yeah, it is confusing. I think part of the confusion is that it's been hard for people to understand how much to value each of the sort of preventive strategies you can take. There's, you know, being outside is itself a preventive strategy, but there's being outside, you know, in a sparsely populated area and being outside in a crowd. And when you're outside in a crowd and people aren't really moving around that much, you know, for example, like at a festival or even at a parade where there's a lot of movement, you know, when you're instead in sort of a stadium, the air above and around the people that you're near doesn't move nearly as much, and you're a lot more likely to actually breathe in somebody else's air. So that is a riskier situation. So being outside is somewhat of a mitigation strategy, but it's not complete. You also need distance and masks if you're going to be in a crowded, I mean, obviously distance doesn't factor in a crowded place, but masks do. And in this Barcelona experiment, this is actually indoors, and it was about a month ago that it ran, where a relatively small proportion of the Spanish population had been vaccinated. And what they did is they tested everybody as they came in. There were 5,000 people in this venue that normally holds about 17,000. They were all on the dance floor rather than in the stands. So it was pretty crowded if you look at pictures. And they weren't instructed to social distance at all, but they were required to wear a medical grade mask, an FFP 5, I think, or 50 mask, over their nose and mouth the whole time. And indeed, there were no infections at that time. So I guess what that says is if everybody wears a mask, then even if people aren't fully, you know, even if everybody isn't vaccinated, as long as you don't have a high level of infection in the group, you can do this safely. But that's not really what we're talking about here, right? We're talking about letting everybody go to a concert outside, letting them do what they want, masks. I don't think masks are going to be mandated at this. I could be wrong. I haven't seen the order. And you're definitely not going to be asking people to be tested on the way in. So this is a really different calculation, and we should not underestimate the risk that could emerge from this.
Jim?
Yeah. I mean, we've got the example of India, which was the epidemiologists there are saying is a case of hubris. Karen, one thing I'd like to know is that because we are not headed toward herd immunity, we are going to be dealing with a whole lot of variants, probably possibly on a seasonal variant. Could we this summer be seeing some offerings of booster shots, of third doses for vaccines?
Yeah, I did read that at least one manufacturer says they plan to release a booster shot before the end of the year. So I think we can expect to see that. But, you know, if people aren't taking the first vaccine, getting them to take the booster shot, I don't think is going to be much easier. I think it'll just continue to protect the people who have opted to take a vaccine for now.
I want to turn to something, which is Jim just mentioned India. India has now about to reach 20 million cases of coronavirus. We know that the coronavirus, even while we're having a break in many states here from the big caseloads that we had for the last year, the world is seeing new record numbers of coronavirus outbreaks. And the question becomes, Karen, We live in a global society. Yes, the United States is now limiting air travel from India, but the world is still experiencing terrible outbreaks of the virus. We're not immune from those outbreaks coming to our shores.
I know, absolutely. And I mean, you sound an awful lot like people sounded in January of last year. And I think it's a little dismaying that we are at this stage and we really don't appear to have globally learned the lessons that this pandemic really has to teach us. And I guess we don't have to. We can continue to exist in this kind of limbo between threat and risk and fear and, you know, true freedom and joy. We don't, you know, I think overcoming that and reconciling ourselves to the sacrifices that we would really have to make in order to globally move the needle on this would take a real cultural shift that I don't think we've made yet.
Hey, Jim, you know, speaking of politics and the virus and speaking of India, it's interesting that Prime Minister Modi in India is now under fire from many quarters, including some within his own party, for not preparing India properly for the virus. But more important, perhaps, for being overly optimistic in the messaging that he said, we've got it under control, we'll take care of it. And in elections, in the last week or so, his party suffered a significant defeat, which suggests that in India, coronavirus is a big political issue, as it was here in our 2020 elections.
Yeah. The Hindu Nationalist Party took a beating, and the parallel with Republicans here in the U.S. is pretty stark. I mean, it's interesting how the message of limited government / boosting economic growth has just been really altered by pandemic politics.
Yeah. Karen, we've only got a couple minutes left in this segment. Let me ask you a more general question. How optimistic are you that by, say, the end of 2021, life will be as close to back to normal as possible? And what are the factors which will make that possible?
You know, I think a lot of that will hinge, Bill, on what we learn about the variant's role in continuing outbreaks. I think right now it's not 100% clear whether those variants are just a consequence of huge amounts of spread or whether they're driving, meaning they're the cause of huge amounts of spread. I think if they're just a consequence and they don't actually drive anything, they don't make anything happen, then I think we may be in a good place. You know, there was an article today in the New York Times that experts are increasingly feeling that herd immunity is not going to happen and we're just going to have to treat this like a seasonal illness. And if that's the case, we will eventually reach a point where most people have been exposed either by vaccine or by illness to one of the antigens, one of the parts of this virus, and have a little bit of immunity as a result. And so it'll be a more low-level type of thing that doesn't result in these huge surges in hospitals every season. But if we find that the variants are actually driving outbreaks, then I think this is just going to slam us over and over and over again until we get the picture as a global society and do something different in how we ourselves volunteer to get vaccinated, how we require vaccination, and just how we see public health and connectedness as part of our lives on Earth.
So, Karen, your message, which we reinforce on this show virtually every day, is, first of all, please keep wearing your mask, whether you're vaccinated or not, and put it over your nose, for goodness sake. I still see people who wear the mask on their mouth. I can't understand what the heck they're thinking, Karen. That's number one, right? Wear the mask.
Yeah, I think that's true. But Bill, you know, another thing that we're learning, it's not actually brand new news to public health, but you can't get people to do things by yelling at them and bossing them and treating them like children. You must approach people with care and with love if you want them to learn something new and do a new behavior.
And that's the key to the other big deal. Get vaccinated. And you're right. It's so easy to give in to being feeling superior or smug and wanting to yell at somebody who doesn't share your thinking about how to protect themselves from the virus. That's never going to get us anywhere, Carrie.
Right. It's not a winning public health strategy. We have to invite people in.
Karen Landman, thank you so much for your insights. Galloway and I are going to talk a little politics. I want to spare you from having to dig into the swamp of partisan politics on the show today, but we are so grateful, Dr. Landman, for your participation in the show today. We will see you again, I'm sure, in the very near future. All right, we got to get to our final pledge break. When we come back, Galloway has big news about the U.S. Senate race featuring Raphael Warnock. Here's how you can support GPB Radio in the meantime. You know, Jim Galloway, I've said this on the show before, but it, given that we're in the middle of our spring pledge drive, it should not go unmentioned right now. You have been on this show from the very beginning, about 7 years ago. I think you were on the very first Political Rewind, and you have, over the years, during your many years at the AJC and then coming on board with us, without question been one of the people that our listeners really value hearing from. And so I'm thrilled that even though you've now stepped aside from your AJC role, we still get the benefit of your wisdom on politics on this show every Monday. So you are an extremely important part of what we do here, and I just want to acknowledge that, Jim.
Well, thank you very much. It does keep me honest, doesn't it?
And speaking of which, you got a tip that is big news. Just last week, there's a lot of buzz around the fact that no major Republican name was stepping forward to challenge Raphael Warnock in the 2022 race. I mean, they are obviously the person who will have to win a GOP primary first. But we have a couple of people who are lesser known, and now it appears there will be a pretty significant Republican name stepping up. Yes?
Right, yeah. This comes from a mutual friend. But the problem heretofore has been the Trump camp, especially out of Mar-a-Lago, has been pushing Herschel Walker, the former UGA great who is a resident of Texas but still has a lot of cachet in Georgia. He has a lot of handicaps as well. He would be a newcomer just like Kelly Loeffler was. And you've got some pushback among Washington Republicans who don't feel that he would be up to defeating Warnock. Okay, now we are hearing that Gary Black, the state agriculture commissioner, is about to jump into the U.S. Senate race against Warnock. This is important for a couple of reasons. Number one, the Republican strategy over the last few cycles has been to really energize the rural white voters, and this is something that Gary Black could bring to the table. He's got two or three statewide election cycles under him, and he's very popular. He's got good contacts, and so this I think is rather important. The only other state known elected official who's considering the race has been Buddy Carter. The other thing that he's the congressman from the Republican congressman from the Savannah area. The other thing this means also is, of course, it means that the you have yet another statewide office vacant coming up in 2022. And Democrats are really eyeing some of these lower tier races that they could go after in a big way, and this is one of them, I think.
I think that's really interesting news. Your point is well taken. I mean, Gary Black has been a very successful and popular ag commissioner. I think I don't know where Gary Black's from in the state.
Oh, boy, I'm going to have to get on my Google real quick to tell you that. I think he's got a residence here now. I don't know where he hails from, but even before, he was just a vital voice in the on the Agribusiness Council during the Tommy Ervin days, the last Democratic Ag Commissioner.
Go ahead.
No, but look, it, regardless of where he's from, it's his network that's actually most important, I think.
The reason I ask that is, and I'm looking him up right now, and I haven't seen where he grew up. I mention that because we know that it's harder to win statewide, certainly as a new candidate, if you're from a rural part of Georgia. But he is now kind of implanted in Atlanta, and his work as ag commissioner certainly has made him well known across the state. So I was just curious about where he actually grew up. I do know he went to the University of Georgia. I see that now. By the way, Buddy Carter, I don't know if you saw this or not, but our friend Adam Van Brimmer, the editorial director of the Savannah Morning News, not long ago, wrote an opinion piece in which he encouraged Buddy Carter to run for U.S. Senate, but the piece was not a compliment. He said, we should do everything we can to get Buddy Carter out of our district because he's just the wrong guy for the U.S. House. It was a very kind of funny piece, actually.
All right. Amelia is reminding me that Gary is from Commerce. Again, important.
Okay, good.
That's North Georgia. Georgia.
That's right.
That's North. It's North Georgia.
Good.
And that's where the votes are.
Thank you, Amelia. So, Jim, we haven't heard about from Herschel Walker yet, but is he a viable candidate for U.S. Senate? Yes, he's a hugely popular football hero in the state, but those kinds of candidates don't necessarily convert their successes in sports to elected office.
No, and look, I'm among those who are hoping that Mr. Walker has got a true friend who will talk to him bluntly and tell him about the realities of campaigning in Georgia. Yes, he's a familiar figure, but he doesn't live here, and thus you can't assume that he knows the issues, he knows the territory. It's the one thing that newly hatched politicians find out about Georgia is that it is a huge state, much like Texas, and it requires a real depth of knowledge. You've got and you've got a fellow who's just an icon who can walk into any Rotary Club, any Kiwanis Club, any gathering in Georgia and be hailed as a hero. If he steps into this primary, a lot of ugly things are going to be coming out. He wrote a book about his struggle with dissociative personality disorder, also known as multi-personality disorder. His ex-wife has accused him of pointing a gun at her. That has to come out in a Republican primary. That will come out in a Republican primary, because these are not tea parties, in the lowercase sense.
Thank you. So Galloway breaks news here on Political Rewind. We're really grateful for that. Let's turn to another interesting subject, Jim. Governor Kemp made a surprise visit to the border. Along the southern border of the United States in Texas on Friday. It was unannounced, but they certainly took full advantage of his visit there on their social media platform. And his ostensible reason for going, of course, was that we have like 300 National Guard troops on the border. But I think it's safe to say there was a political motivation behind it as well, yes?
Yeah, and I would just suspect that there might have been a videographer with him putting together some B-roll material for the coming 2022 campaign. What it tells you is that this is going to be 2022 is going to be yet another base election. And it's going to be a nationalized election, and it's going to be about immigration is going to be one of those big factors. That's you see Republicans in Washington already identifying that as one of Joe Biden's potential weaknesses, and where they're going to hit him. So that's Kemp is kind of an interesting play for a governor who is still more than slightly on the outs with a Trump base in Georgia.
He sat down with Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who is about as conservative as Brian Kemp is, and Abbott gave him a little boost, saying how wonderful it was that the governor cares about the situation at the border. And of course, we should point out, and from a political point of view, Jim, that in one of his tweets about his visit, He criticized Kamala Harris. He said, if Vice President Harris isn't willing to come to the border, I am. And of course, Republicans are going to do all they can to take advantage of the fact that there are people who believe the Biden administration has been slow to respond to the serious problems that continue to develop along the border. They still don't seem to have a plan in place to deal with the surge of immigrants with children who are being kept in facilities that are maybe questionable. And that's going to be a weakness that they'd better deal with, the Democrats have got to deal with here in Georgia and across the country in 2022 elections.
Right. And you know, you've got Biden talking about the possibility of a large-scale immigration reform effort. I just don't think that's going to happen in a 2022 climate. When you've got Republicans on the bubble, in a position to take over not only the House but possibly the Senate as well, and that which brings us back to that U.S. Senate race. And if we could back up just a little bit to Governor Kemp here, what's interesting here is the plays that are being made behind the kind of the Republican curtain. You have Governor Kemp, who's on the outs with Trump voters, but you've got Gary Black, who's a solid Trump supporter, but also very popular with the Republican establishment, throwing himself out as an alternative to a real Trump candidate in Herschel Walker. Then you've also got Jody Heiss, the U.S. representative from the Athens area, who is running against Brad Raffensperger, and if you think about, in my mind, I think one of Kemp's real problems might be, is if in a primary Kemp wins, he beats Vernon Jones, and Jody Heiss beats Brad Raffensperger, so you've got a Trump supporter who disavowed the results of the 2020 election in the Secretary of State's position as a candidate, but you've got a governor who upheld that race, and that's going to be a conflict. And that's Gary Black kind of helps Kemp over that hump, I think.
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, what you point out is fascinating to me. It's increasingly looking, and we don't know it for sure because there's plenty of time before the primary next spring, but increasingly it appears that Brian Kemp is going to dodge a serious challenge in the Republican Party. Doug Collins isn't going to go after him. But of course, what's really going to matter is that general election race. And that's where all this Trumpiness could come into play in a major way for Brian Kemp in a reelection campaign.
Right. If Brad Raffensperger is the Republican candidate for re-election as Secretary of State, I think Kemp is in a much stronger position. But if it's Jody Heiss, not so much.
Yeah, Jim, we are out of time for today's Political Rewind. I'm a little sorry because I was really hoping we could talk Stone Mountain and the efforts there to turn things around. But let's put that on hold. There's going to be plenty of time to talk about it. And I want to talk about it with you because you have been a driving force in suggesting how important it is for the Stone Mountain Authority to do something to change the way in which that park is interpreted by people today. And so we will do something about that in an upcoming show. In the meantime, thank you for being with us today and giving us that great Gary Black story. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, take care, stay healthy, wear your mask above your nose, and encourage your friends to get the vaccine you've already gotten. Here's how you can support GPB Radio.